As I'm sitting here in this moment, my heart is full and a little bit heavy. As I was preparing this talk on the aspect of wisdom from the perspective of understanding impermanence, unreliability, and not self, I got an email message informing me that a student of mine had died. A surprise. A reminder to us all that we don't know. We never know. I had a meeting planned with this student next week, and I don't get to have that meeting. So that was very present in my heart right now, and I felt like I needed to say that. And it ties directly to the topic of the talk. We've been talking about really getting to know this human experience. Really knowing this human experience from the inside, what it is to live as a human being, and this encompasses so much beauty and so much sadness. We've been, this morning, Greg talked a lot about seeing the nature of our experience. And this nature of our experience, there's different ways we can look at the nature of our experience. We can get familiar with our specific experiences, get to know just the pressure and vibration and pulsing and just this lived kind of vibratory experience with all of its senses and moods and thoughts and emotions, that kind of inner world that meets the outer world. We talk about meeting our inner experience, and yet that inner experience contains the outer experience. The sights are ostensibly outside of us, and yet what we know of the sights is how the form and color impacts our eye and takes shape in our mind. And so there's really not so much of a distinction between inner and outer. And so we can explore this side of our experience, this nature of our experience, the kind of we could say maybe the specific nature of our experience. And then there's a more, let's say, general nature of our experience. You know, we can get familiar with sights and form and color and start to recognize sounds and how they land on the ear, and then recognize how the mind gets into play with all of this, and hearing a specific sound, recognizing it, that's all specific. At a more general level, every single experience we have, every single experience that happens in this mind and body, shares some natures. In some ways, sights are very different from sounds, and yet they share the nature of being just this momentary arising and passing. A sight appears and vanishes. A sound appears and vanishes. And so all of our experience shares these, what we could call, three general natures. They're impermanent. There's no experience that we have that lasts. And actually, it lasts way shorter than we even think it lasts. No experience, because it isn't kind of almost as a follow-on from this nature of all experience being impermanent. There's no experience that we can have that's reliable as a place for lasting happiness. There's nothing we can find in our experience that we could, of which we can finally land on and say, this is it. This is what is going to make me happy. And so experience is impermanent and unreliable as in terms of being a place for lasting happiness. And it is not self. This one a little more difficult to describe in a couple of words, but maybe I'll just say it in this simple way, that what we think of as self is not what it appears to be. There's nothing, maybe we could talk about the insubstantiality of experience, that there's no thing to be found in any of our experience. Even as we see a sight, hear a sound, it's already vanishing, it's already going. So there's no thing there. It's all process, all a flow of conditioned experience. This is the reflection or understanding around the teaching of not self. As we see, start to touch into our experience, we may begin to recognize this general nature of experience. And we don't want it to be so. You know, we don't want it to be so. We want things to be permanent. We want things to be reliable. And it sure feels like there's a self. But what we start to see, too, is that the way we struggle in our lives is essentially because we, in our way we navigate the world, we are not in alignment with this nature, with the nature of experience being impermanent, unreliable, not self. We resist these natures. We somehow or sometimes even believe that these natures can't be true, can't be right. It must be my fault that I'm not able to find a lasting happiness. And so it is through the not seeing of this, of these natures, of this general nature of experience, through the not seeing of this, that we suffer, that we struggle. And as we begin to align ourselves with this nature, with the nature of things as they actually are, we suffer way less. This understanding, this wisdom, not the intellectual wisdom, yeah, I know things are impermanent, but the deep experiential understanding of this nature of experience This frees our minds. So the topic is wisdom and how we begin to experience and understand this wisdom directly through our practice. Wisdom is one of these paramis. I talked about it a little bit the other night with respect to energy, that a certain direction of wisdom, understanding, is what helps to guide our energy in the direction that will help, basically will help us to understand this nature. And so that's one perspective on wisdom of that I talked about the other night, this perspective on recognizing what's helpful and not helpful in terms of what leads us to suffering is not helpful. What leads us away from suffering, that's helpful. And as we explore our experience with directing our energy in that way, we begin to actually directly understand these truths and begin to understand how our struggles, how our suffering is created by not being in alignment with these truths, with this nature. Maybe we shouldn't even call it truth. Maybe we should call it the nature of our experience. Because really, my understanding of the way the Buddha taught, he wasn't speaking so much about truth or reality in the world. He was speaking about the nature or the truth or the reality of experience. And that within our experience, suffering is constructed. And within our experience, this nature of seeing impermanent, unreliable, not self can be known. Seeing that nature in experience is what frees us. Whether there's actually something out there that's permanent is kind of beside the point. It is more about what's this experience and understanding that there is no experience that is reliable. And yet, we try to cling to it, we try to hold on to it, and there we suffer. So in this teaching on wisdom, there's one place where the wisdom is described as being first. The first way we contact wisdom is through hearing about it. We just begin to take in. Somebody says, hey, things are impermanent. We take that in. The second kind of wisdom, or let's say somebody says that and says, hey, this is important, you know. It's like, this is an important thing. Things are impermanent. Experience is unreliable. Pay attention. This is important. This is helpful for alleviating suffering. So this is a form of wisdom that's offered in a teaching, for example. The second form of wisdom, or the second way wisdom begins to kind of operate or to begin to be massaged in our system, is that we begin to reflect on it. We think about it, perhaps. We use the teaching perhaps to explore something. And so it's brought in through the intellect and massaged in the intellect, kind of. And kind of begins to infiltrate our system that way and to inform how we explore, look at. It's kind of almost like a hypothesis that we start to look at our experience and say, is everything impermanent? Can't find any contradictions. Keep looking. And then the third kind of wisdom, or the third level of wisdom perhaps, that really begins to free us is where we see directly, understand experientially some aspect of that nature. So it's not just an idea in our minds. We actually see within our experience. As I said, this is the nature of experience. The nature of experience is that it's impermanent, unreliable, not self. And we can see this directly within our experience. So this is the third level, and this is the level that really begins to free the mind. When we see for ourselves, when the mind understands something is impermanent, it has no wish to cling to it because it understands there's a futility to that. And that way lies suffering to cling to it. And so this is kind of the experiential level. And so we learn about these three natures at all three of these levels. This first one, first nature, impermanence, experience is impermanent. At so many levels we can see this, and at so many levels we know this. I mean, you ask anybody, do things change? They say yes. So it's not so much of a surprise to us. You know, seasons change, the weather changes, we change, our friends change. Our things change, we grow old, we get sick. We die, our friends die. So it's not so much a surprise to us that this happens. And yet, you know, it is a surprise to us when you get an email that says, oh, this person you were going to talk to next week has died. Something in me was a little surprised. You know, it's like, wow, I didn't expect that. Why not? It can happen to any person at any moment. In fact, there's a teaching story in the Hindu tradition where one person is reflecting on what is the greatest wonder in the world. And that person reflects, the greatest wonder in the world is that beings seeing daily people passing away, hearing that news of people dying and passing away, think that they are immortal, that this will not happen to them. It said that this truth in this story, the reflection goes on, this truth of our mortality, only the surface mind understands. It doesn't go deep into our hearts. And so even reflecting on this ordinary understanding, this everyday understanding that things change, is actually pretty potent. I was told many of you may have heard of the writer and spiritual teacher Carlos Castaneda, who studied with Don Juan, and he became a teacher in his own right, Carlos Castaneda. And I heard a story of a time he was having a conversation with a number of people, and one of the people asked him or said to him, I just don't feel like I have a spiritual life. And Carlos Castaneda responded, reflect regularly that your family, your children, your friends, and yourself will all die, and in no particular order. You will soon have a spiritual life. So this reflection, we don't reflect on it very much. We don't take in this fact. Partly maybe because we think it would be depressing, but I've actually found it almost the opposite. I regularly, frequently when I'm driving on the freeway, I reflect. This could be the last time I drive to IMC. And it doesn't create a sense of doom or depression, but it does enliven my heart to recognize this moment is precious. Do I want to waste this moment with impatience or anger? And so this reflection, just on our own mortality, can be so powerful. The Buddha encourages us to reflect on impermanence. There's a chant. I've learned it as a chant called the Five Subjects for Frequent Recollection. And four of these are related to impermanence. I am of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to sicken. I have not gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying. All that I have, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. These things we should frequently recollect. I put that on my bathroom mirror at one point, just reminding myself daily, this is the nature of being alive. Aging, sickness, death, separation. I had a really clear demonstration of the non-depressing nature of this wisdom, let's say, because this monk in Burma that Greg has told some stories about, Myatong Sayadaw, he called him the happy Sayadaw the other day. Also, probably the happiest being I've ever met. I went to visit him not quite the last time I was there, but maybe it wasn't the last time I saw him, but it was close. And we went to see him, and we'd heard that he'd been sick, so we were a little concerned for his health and asked after his health. And he was speaking through a translator, but it's interesting because I had such a sense that I understood exactly what he was saying. It's like he was speaking to me in English. And the transmission of what he said was, we said, oh, we heard you were sick, Sayadaw. I hope you're okay. And he said, oh, yes, I almost died the other day. Laughing like that. It was such a lesson, such a beautiful, beautiful expression. As we explore in meditation, we also start to see impermanence, not just at this obvious level around aging, sickness, death, separation, but also at a much more moment-to-moment level. It's kind of startling when we really enter into watching our experience at certain times or certain continuity of mindfulness, the mind can begin to see just how rapidly things are changing. There's a sensation in the body that comes and goes. There's a sight that shifts immediately. It's actually kind of amazing that our minds put things together at all. That, a face or something moving by us is changing so rapidly. It's amazing that we look at a face and think it's the same face. Our mind does that. Our mind creates this sense of something there, sense of stability. What's actually going on in our visual field, in our auditory field, is this rapid, shifting, changing experience. And our mind creates a stability. A car driving by, the sight of that, it's changing so fast. Every single moment, it's different sight. And yet our mind understands that it's something driving by. So there's a way in which there's something there, that at an experiential level, we start to see just how impermanent things are. Things don't last for a split second. We start to see in our meditation, beginnings and endings become obvious. We feel the beginning of an in-breath, and it wasn't there a moment before, and whew, there's a surprise, there's an in-breath. Or a sound arises suddenly, and oh, there's a sound, and whew, it ends, it vanishes. These are very simple experiences, and yet at a certain place in meditation, it's almost like a surprise that a sound, something that you're hearing is suddenly gone. Or some experience that you're having. I was doing my work meditation at one retreat. It was a pretty early retreat, and I was still getting familiar with my own emotions and recognizing just how attached I was to them and how much I held on to them and reacted to them. And I was scraping my pots. And I picked up the pot and I was scraping it, and I was feeling angry. It's like, oh, anger, okay. It's like, wow. Lots of anger scraping this pot. And at that point, it's kind of like, wow, I guess I'm going to be angry the rest of the day. You know, was what my mind thought at that moment. I was scraping the pot, and I was just going, okay, anger. I was actually noticing it. And I put the pot down, picked up the next pot, and joy was there. And anger was vanished. And I was like, what? What happened? So sometimes this it can be startling, but this is actually wisdom at work, revealing the impermanent nature of our experience. We see something there, we see it vanish. The mind is in a place of wisdom to be able to really understand the impermanent nature of experience. So this is part of practice, actually. At a certain point in practice, it's helpful not so much to be interested in the anger or the joy or the sight or the sound, but in just how it's changing, arising, vanishing. Sometimes something vanishes so thoroughly. I've had a time when I was like caught in some idea, and then the mind recognized, oh, that's a thought. And in that very recognition, it vanishes. And in the next moment, it's like it's so vanished, I can't even remember what it was. The mind more interested in the impermanent side of it than in the content of what it was. And so this is wisdom at work. The mind recognizing this impermanent nature of experience. There's so much to say about each of these. I'm going to try just to do a kind of an overview of each one. So the second, the characteristic of, or the nature of unreliability. So what does it mean that experience is unreliable? I mentioned it before that it's unreliable in terms of being a place to find lasting happiness. It's unreliable as something that we could hold on to that will satisfy us, that will ultimately satisfy us. So I think Greg really described this pretty clearly at one point, just this pattern that we have. We understand at some level that things are unreliable. I mean, this nature of unreliability, or this nature of the Pali word here is dukkha. That experience is dukkha. In this case, not necessarily meaning suffering, but this unreliable nature of experience, inherently unsatisfactory nature of experience. And some experience is clearly unsatisfactory in that it already is unpleasant. It's already, you know, painful, and we'd like to get rid of it if we could. So there, you know, there, that kind of experience is all, it's kind of obvious to us that it's not a reliable place for happiness. We are trying to figure out how to get rid of it. On the other side is pleasant experience, which we may at some level believe, yes, that's where I will find happiness. Although we do understand at some, we understand at some level that pleasant and unpleasant experience come and go. And yet this doesn't stop us from trying to find happiness, to construct our experience in terms of getting rid of unpleasant experience and finding pleasant experience. It's as if we can create a string of all pleasant experience or the disappearance of unpleasant experience, that would be success in our lives. It's like if we can figure out how to control our lives such that we'd have only pleasant experience, that's what we think should be possible. And that this teaching on unreliability basically says it's not possible to have that kind of experience where we can construct things to be the way we want them to be all the time. It just doesn't happen. So this is our pattern. We continue looking for things to make us happy. We feel like we failed or we've done something wrong, or we've been betrayed, or the world is to blame, perhaps, if we are not finding a way to that happiness. Someone is to blame. Maybe us, it may be somebody else, or it may be just the universe to blame. But this is just the nature of things. It's so much easier to come into alignment with that nature. We don't have to take it personally anymore. In seeing this kind of wisdom at work, again, in our practice, we start to touch into the wisdom around unreliability. It expresses itself as we see experience. Some of it in this particular category is not so easy, because you have all seen this. Anybody not seen suffering experience this week? You know, it's like we get to see this. We get to see how our minds struggle. We have unpleasant experience, we don't like it, we feel the extra suffering of that. This wisdom around unreliability, this wisdom around dukkha, partly we get to see very clearly that experience, certain experience is suffering. When experience is unpleasant, we directly recognize, yes, this is unpleasant. When there's a reaction to that unpleasantness, anger, for instance. This was actually one of my early insights, you know, seeing the wisdom around dukkha at work. It was kind of a surprise. I mean, I was looking at anger. Anger was a pattern that had been kind of running my life, and I started getting curious about it. Became one of my very first practices. See anger when it arises. And after some time of this, it's kind of like I recognized that in that arising of anger, I was angry at a particular person. This person had done me wrong. And I was right. And lots of self-justification there. So the anger came up, and partly because I was so self-righteous and so sure I was right and that person was wrong, it was like that seemed to mask somehow the suffering of the anger. But at some point, because I was watching the anger, I was getting to know the anger, at some point I recognized that I believed that this anger that I was experiencing would cause pain and suffering for the other person. And that actually quickly became revealed as not going to happen, because I happened to be in the middle of the South Pacific. I was in the Peace Corps at the time, and I was on an island in the middle of the South Pacific, and this person was living in California. It's like, okay, that's a delusion there. That's a delusion that I think this is going to make the other person miserable. And in the same recognition, I saw, oh, it's making me miserable. This anger is making me miserable. I somehow thought it was going to make the other person miserable, but it's making me miserable. This is wisdom at work. This is understanding of the truth, of the suffering nature of our experience. It didn't feel good. You know, sometimes we think, oh, insight, that's going to be like, ah. Sometimes insight is into suffering. Anger hurts. It was a little bit of a shock. It's like, wow, somehow I'd been thinking this anger was serving me, but it's hurting me. Now, this is a way we can see this. This is dukkha. This is suffering. This is... Sometimes in our meditation, we see that our suffering, and this is one of the understandings around dukkha, that we see that the our struggles are created by holding on to something, by wanting something to be other than it is, usually by resisting impermanent nature of experience, by wanting some control in some way. And some part of our mind just really latches, got to be some way to control this, or some way to fix this, or some way to change this. And yet we're suffering all in the same time. So sometimes we feel into that suffering, and we know, we see the way our mind is latched on. And yet we don't know how to let go. You know, we can see there's a craving there. We can see there's a clinging there. And we don't know how to let go. And this also is not a mistake. You know, our patterns, our habits around craving are so strong. Sometimes what we get to see in our meditation is the strength of that habit. I remember sitting at the 3-month course in so much pain and seeing just how deeply my mind was clinging to something, wanting it to not be there. And I said to myself, I'd let go if I knew how. But that moment, in that moment, the lesson is, this is suffering. This clinging itself, the way that you're holding on, this is suffering. There's a learning. Again, you know, sometimes our insight, sometimes the wisdom is pointing out to us that our habitual ways of being in the world don't serve us. So sometimes that's the way wisdom feels doesn't always feel good, but it's pointing to something that helps the mind begin to release. Because as our minds, I think I said this the other day, as our minds begin to recognize that it's something that they're doing that is contributing to our suffering, the mind begins to want to let go and begins to understand, kind of like from underneath, how to let go. We sometimes cannot do the letting go. Actually, wisdom, as wisdom strengthens, wisdom is what allows the mind to let go. The real deep understanding of the impermanent, unreliable nature of experience, the mind begins to let go of the ways it grasps onto things. We also, of course, see the wanting for pleasant experience. This is the flip side of it. There's, of course, the pain of reactivity and the habitual patterns. Our minds are so amazing that they think, this anger is going to serve me. This frustration is going to, our minds think it's going to get something out of that somehow. And then it begins to learn that whatever it thinks it's going to get out of it isn't worth the pain that it's experiencing in the moment. And then there's the other side, the side of moving towards something pleasant. And what's wrong with that? What's the problem there? Why not just get the next hit of something pleasant? Well, this is a little more counterintuitive or less obvious. It's a less obvious kind of suffering in a way. We want something. We want to become someone. We want to be a good meditator or be a person that everybody likes or something. And so we orient towards that wanting. Now that direction, I think we've talked a little bit about the distinction between aspiration and desire. There's a kind of way that we would like to head towards being, we'd like to head towards becoming a person who's not engaged in harming, for instance. That's a worthy aspiration. And yet there's a way that we can kind of put that aspiration out there and just move in that direction. And there's a kind of way we can create an image and say, that's what I want to be. And if I'm not measuring up to that, I'm bad, I'm wrong, I'm a failure, I haven't figured it out yet. And we suffer over that. So that's one way in which that creation of something pleasant and trying to move towards something pleasant creates a stress in us. If we're not living up to that ideal, we failed. And so there's suffering there. And even in the very wanting to move towards something pleasant, this is also harder to see at times, but if you want something, the wanting is so focused on the thing that we want. It's focused on that pleasant thing we're going to get. And our mind is living in that future moment that we're going to get that thing and we're going to be happy in that moment. Our mind has created this future reality in which we have that thing and happiness will follow. Permanent happiness, hopefully. So there, that's the vision that our mind has created. That's the vision our mind is living in. And it is not in the present moment to be available to know that the wanting for that experience already has created a sense of lack, a sense of unsatisfactoriness in our experience. As soon as there's wanting in our experience, there's already a sense of lack. And that sense of lack is suffering. Again, our minds obscure this. Delusion obscures this by projecting into that idea of happiness in the future. It's like we're willing. Delusion is willing to forego happiness here and now for the possibility of a moment of happiness in the future? Is it worth it? Is it worth it? Sometimes we might say, yes, it's worth it. We do that a lot. But it's worthwhile to look at the pattern underlying that, the wanting itself. We can see the wanting, feel the suffering of the wanting. And in one experience, I was exploring the wanting itself, wanting to look at people on retreat. It was a 3-month course and really wanted to look at people. And I explored this wanting every time there was somebody there. And I began to recognize that the wanting was conditioned. It sprung up as people came into view. And it vanished when people went out of view. And in feeling that wanting vanish, it felt like I was released from a vice grip. It was way more easeful to have that wanting release than to have satisfied that wanting by looking at the person. A much more profound sense of ease and peace to have that wanting release. This again is wisdom at work. We see, we can see, and we can be curious, explore, wanting. You know, sometimes the best wantings to look at are the ones that are the smallest, the ones we might think, you know, well, what's the harm of getting that second muffin? They were really good muffins. What's the harm in that? You know, there's no particular, you know, it's not like it's unethical to do that. But we are missing an opportunity in some ways because wanting fuels our lives. And wanting can be very strong. And when wanting is very strong, it's harder to be able to hang out with. Maybe the wanting of a second muffin, you can hang out with that. Watch it. It's not so threatening, perhaps, to hang out with that wanting and not follow through on it. Just see it. Feel the, like, tractor beam pull towards the muffins. That's like, you know, the wanting has that feeling, like a magnet, muffins. Feel that pull and see how long it lasts, when it disappears, what happens. Sometimes it might just be you kind of get bored with watching it and you go away, and it's like it kind of goes away in the when you don't see it go away. You know, you might just walk away from the table and kind of still a little pull, a little less pull the further you get. Then your mind kind of moves to something else and you forget about the muffin and it's kind of gone, but you didn't really see it going. At some point you might actually get to watch a wanting and then see that wanting vanish and feel the release that comes with that. That supports the wisdom in the moment to really recognize even how something as simple as wanting to look at somebody or wanting to have a second muffin, how much our heart is constricted by that wanting. Simple wanting like that has that kind of constriction. How much more so for the bigger wantings of our lives? And the third kind of nature, not self, unsubstantiality. Another way to consider this is kind of the Buddha talked about the out of control nature of our experience, and he asks us to reflect. You know, if experience were self, it would be possible to say of experience, "May my experience be thus. May my experience not be thus." You know. Can we say that? May my body be thus. May my mind be thus. May anger vanish. Boy, that would be nice. He points to the fact that we can't do that, not as some inherent problem or flaw in ourselves, but as a manifestation of not self. He says, body is not self, therefore it's not possible to say of body, may my body be thus, may my body not be thus. Feeling is not self, so it's not possible to say a feeling, may my feeling be thus, may my feeling not be thus. This is another way of expressing this not self nature of experience, the uncontrollability, the basic uncontrollability of experience. There's certain ways in which we have agency, in which we can make choices. There is agency in the system. It's not our agency. It's not my agency. There's an agency, there's an ability of the system to weigh things, decide things, make choices. And yet there's not a kind of, let's say, a reliable controllability of experience. And the Buddha points to this as being not self. Another way to point to this, everything that we experience is in flux. It's a process, conditioned phenomenon tumbling on. There is something coherent to this conditioned process. It's not that there's nothing there, but we can't point to it and say, this is me. It's kind of maybe an analogy for this. There's a couple of analogies. And one analogy is like a river. You know, you can't point to anything about the river and say, that's the river. You know, it's like the water. We might think the water's the river, but you take a bucket of water out of the river, it's like, is that the river? No, in fact, the water that's there is already downstream. So it's continually flowing, continually changing the water. Maybe the riverbed is the river. Well, no, a storm can change that too. It's in flux too. It's continually eroding, continually wearing away. So there's a process. There's something that's got some kind of streaming to it. There's a streaming quality. There's a set of conditions and flow that we call the river. But there's no thing we can point to and say that's the river. Maybe we can point to the name. But the name isn't the river, it's just a name. Another analogy that can point to this is a rainbow. You know, a rainbow is a set of conditions that come together, very ephemeral conditions that come together. There's many pieces that have to be just right. There has to be the mist in the air, the rain in the air, the sun has to be at a specific angle, and then an observer has to be at a specific place. Those three things have to be there. If any one of them is any different, the appearance of the rainbow is not going to happen. It's an appearance. The rainbow is an appearance. It comes into being based on conditions. It vanishes when conditions change. Our being is kind of like that. And our sense of self, there's this set of conditions tumbling on that have some kind of flow to it. I mean, it's like my thoughts aren't your thoughts. My memories related to my past are arising based on conditions from the past. But that past doesn't exist anymore. There's just this tumbling on of conditions now. This truth of not self is actually staring us in the face. But our view, our perspective that there is a self obscures the evidence. There's actually a lot of evidence for not self. I mean, just what the Buddha was pointing to. It's like the fact that we can't say of some arising mind state, anger, be gone, is evidence for not self. These states of mind are not self. They have come into being based on conditions. They will leave when conditions change. They are not self. The arising of, well, here's another one. I think Greg mentioned this the other day. You know, we're sitting meditating. We sit down. Our intention is to stay present. That's the sense of self there. I'm going to stay present. How long does it last that you can stay with the breath? 3 breaths? Maybe? The mind wanders. Did you do that? Did you choose for your mind to wander? Not self. It's not that you failed. It's the nature of mind to be uncontrollable. And then mindfulness returns. Who did that? That too is not self. Not self is staring us in the face. We just can't see it because we believe that there's something here that exists. So there are ways that we can see this in our direct experience, begin to taste the truth, the nature of not self. And actually, we see this more often than we think. I think one of the simplest and most early insights that we have, experience of wisdom arising, is when we are noticing some challenging state of mind, like frustration or anxiety, and something in us is able to just say, oh, it's just anxiety. What's this? What's this human experience of anxiety? That there's a little shift of perspective where we shift from being caught in the anxiety, believing it's a problem, to, oh, it's just anxiety happening in the moment. There's like, feels like there's a little space around the experience. Easier to just witness that experience as a human experience. That shift of perspective is a letting go, a loosening of the sense of self or identification around that state of mind. Instead of it being my anxiety, my problem, it's, oh, this is just the human experience of anxiety. This is that. So there's a way that we experience wisdom at work in that moment around this understanding of not self. There's so many more ways that we see this. I have others listed here, and I'm not going to have an opportunity to share them with you in this moment. So what I'd like to kind of close with is just pointing to, I've talked about certain ways in which we begin to taste or begin to recognize these natures in our experience, the meditative directly in our experience, we begin to recognize, oh, this is impermanent. This is unreliable. This is dukkha. This is just, that's a way I phrase that sometimes. This is just, or it's just causes and conditions tumbling on. We see that directly. And this is wisdom at work in the moment. Wisdom is not something, you know, grand or like something out there. It actually is cultivated by our choice to attend to our experience in this way that we've been playing with. Looking at what's helpful, what's not helpful, creates the conditions for these understandings to arise. And that space of understanding is also impermanent. Conditions are created, continuity of mindfulness, a few moments of being able to see something clearly, of understanding, oh, this is not a problem. And then 2 minutes later, it's a problem again. You know, that's also just the nature of the mind. the conditions for wisdom come and go. And yet, the fact that it has, that we have seen something clearly like that, we have seen a moment of, oh, it's just anxiety. When we're caught back in anxiety, we can remember that we had that perspective once. It doesn't negate the perspective. It doesn't negate the fact. I mean, sometimes I've seen that happen that, oh, I must have just been deluding myself when I saw that. Actually, it's more like delusion at work now that we can't see that. When you see it clearly, there is no question that we are seeing the nature of experience. And yet that seeing comes and goes. And when it's gone, if we cannot second guess ourselves, we can recognize, okay, this is, somebody asked a question about delusion, we may touch into it a little bit later. This is just the mind caught by delusion. I've seen it otherwise. And now there's the possibility of knowing, okay, this is just the mind caught by a belief. This is the mind caught by a view. And so seeing these moments, these small moments, they're a pointer for us. They head us in the direction of freedom. Thank you for your attention.